Jonathan brought some books which would be worth looking at afterwards, which are all jargon books. Two books of mine over the last 5 or 6 years have been published by Jargon, so there were copies of them. They're not necessarily things I think that I would read had I known I was going to read, but it's nice to be forced into taking another look, especially since I've recently started learning French, and I've been giving poems titles in French, and they all seem a little bit chicer than when I wasn't speaking French. These are three idiolects. Flina gruba sa gerimden, winters reked rock, treden und treden tuff, nagel on flat uta stig. Na me fira rekel, but kittling a me hand and foot na leaflich be me but rim, a kudel on my arm, and hug I long it been gone from me on. All new all thunk be is. Ul hulish lif, ven vin far vest, bring out na car, but his brit room. Twerfrein duer ins, ech green lich, da ul mus e meme song, da son his skimmer. Those three poems written in a language that I invented, to write them in, because I've been reading Anglo-Saxon and some Old Norse and kept sort of cursing that they were seemed marvelous, but it was very, very hard to write in them, and I didn't know enough to do it, and I thought if I did it would be a bit pretentious. Rather than the huge hubris of making up a language to write a poetry and then only producing three fragments. In close to the same vein, but in English this time, solstice hymn, loom song. White maize, red dark berries, stark twigs, hedges web frays, every weft toss tangles warp more, thaw and frost slacken its weave, thick sap grows sluggish as loom's hum fades. Ice skeins and aurelii late as summer raveled, lard each tree, sustain robin's reedy song, tit and wren tug at suet, peck seed strewn over walls. Raw air ashy light, slag sun limes fells to catch night, to untwist birds' chirps, bringing them back to their boughs. Belt and sword armor leap up to sky, apt tools to poke embers, to stir up flare. Mind's flame dissolves heart's icy sleeve, dreams melt, coagulate, a core. Fire flickers, plays upon familiar things, plying focus, wood ash weaves, well-being, strengthening, the seasoned fabric, mending, patching. Day's tread rethreads, the shuttle wakes, reworks, undoes sleep's botch. Star, bird, leaf, earth, sky, winter patterns constellate, unfold the cloth. This is a poem called Callans, and it was written during the first summer that I came to England with Jonathan Williams about 10 years ago and arrived in the winter in a Yorkshire dale, and then started setting up, there was a cottage that was being redone, and then we came back the next spring and could move into this cottage. So this poem was a kind of urgency behind writing it, which I didn't really realize at the time, was to come to grips, not very firm grips, but to come to grips with this tiny area which I walked, and all of my feelings for it, which were a funny combination of mostly being a foreigner, which was a wonderful sensation to have. This poem is called Callans. All the place names and are right around within walking distance of his cottage in what was then Yorkshire and is now Cumbria. At dusk, iridescent starlings swarm with slugs, spiders, snails in their beaks. At dusk, iridescent starlings swarm with slugs, spiders, snails in their beaks. Stones house noise in the eaves gap, hollows of moss-lined straw, dry grass, demanding young, ugly, fat, and hungry. Sheep bleat, dog bark, far call of peewit, rook. Bouquets of lilac and ajuga, mouse ear and sprays of white hawthorn maize arranged in kilner jars. Empty corners flooded by columns, spiraling motes, flecks of shadows from green elder. Sweet smells on moist air, clouds over helm's knot, rain on window ledge. The new-hewn lintel admits sunlight. Summer's hedges are laid, lithe saplings bent back, threaded in, tender, unfurled bracken fronds, shelter and indwelling, verdant articulation, nets of enclosure, stinted allotments, dry, blue rag walls. A grotto of rocks thick with moss where leaves bower, hidden ethers, latent air that opens up deep chambers, lighting the mine's cave. They are the door flag and architrave, inroad under a stead, passage to something tremulous, vibrating, fleet. A faint glist lifts the haze, incandescence wraps each pore, webs cast up, seeds lost in the word hoard. Replicas of distant, clouded soundings housed by shining husks, foliate blazons. Plait the cord, knot and cross, tie it off with acorn bobbin, bee and spider, rowan, pimpernel, sinigreen, cold iron. Rushlight shrinks the room, extends the outer margin. Vocatus atque, non vocatus, deus adirit. Invoked or not, the god presents himself. Pausing, head turned, the beast sees what beckons. Horsetail and horns, bison head, cloven hoof, flute music. Men in chamois disguise leap. By torchlight and smoke, red ochre handprint. Chipped flint, bare skull and bones and coffers, apron, bracelet, crown of Nassus, discs, ivory rings, trochus shells, lush evidence of a dance, footfall and beat, ancient sun, striking stone, grass on the flanks, upwinder the calf down Cotley by Raleigh Bridge, ghost of a broken stone circle, song of skylark high off Bramrig top, scores the air, fades like slender rushes brought down fells, dry, strewn over flags to sweeten the house. June gloam settles on home fell, a casual heap of earth and rock, ramparts where huts ringed, a green hollow, the half-light turns to shadow. Gypsy caravans pulled up in a clearing off the lane by loon near Otter Wood, dusk thickens and vanishes in their campfire. Cross shaft carved with a figure bound and interlaced, Loki netted, disjointed webbing, twists of threads and cast up images, stone beaks peck stone fruit, bewcastles cross, designs the rhyme, vine scrolls and knotwork, patterns interweaving the lines, dense, intricate scheme, rendering it whole, lift and fall like a heron's wing. Scattered wall stones, clumps of cow parsley, nettles and catnip, flies swarm, rise in black clouds above fresh cow dung. Day reaches ripeness in sunlight. Doors open and admit a bright dust to its original source. The air swells, gathering sparks, the house fills with a seed fire lost by hesitant glance. Dark corners center, each shape quakes, empty spaces shine, invoked, embodied. The next is called A Valentine for Jonathan. Has a little epitaph. Again, now that I know French, I can be even fancier. This epitaph's in Greek, and it's the first line of Sappho's Ode to Aphrodite. It shows every sort of Poundian disciple, apparently, knowing Poikilothron Athanata Aphrodita. A Valentine to Jonathan. Poikilothron Athanata Aphrodita. How many times I saw her feathery hemline dapple her embroidered sandal strap, her wrists rest content in that lap all desire draws us to, and not saw her chair she sits upon, inlaid with all her wiles. She, a cunning lady, hair color violets, limbs lithe as sparrow wings, her eyes wink, her head nods us the way to bed. Were there pillows there? No, nothing arrests attention, attests to anything but her look, undying, there always, even when unseen, each spring, dog-toothed violets appear, admitted as if to that spectrum, as if we had something better to do than look for what's there when they aren't, or she's not. I'd like to maybe close with, and I've never actually read this, which is why I thought an occasion like this would be a good time to read it. It may bore the pants off of everyone. It's always seemed rather long to me, but there isn't much on a page, so I decided. It's sort of begins as a ballad. It's a kind of disintegration of the ballad called The Telling of Sir Thomas Valentine. It's terribly pre-Raphaelite in its attempt to be authentic, I mean, and to belong to the world of real ballads, or the world of, maybe beginning with the world of the Grail legend or something like that. The Telling of Sir Thomas Valentine. And the meters are intuitive rather than metrical, I mean, rather than rigid. Good Sir Thomas Valentine rode out to pound... Oh, wait a minute. Good Sir Thomas Valentine. Good Sir Thomas Valentine rode out to pawn his mount in quest. He sought to seek the hill made of wood, planks as fine as ever built the house, as ever built the horse of Troy, flanked its slope and steps. No king could boast of bettering that joinery. The sun shone upon good Sir Thomas and his shield. The heart of its cross, the chalice, tilted by an invisible hand, poured a flow of silver filigree, brighter than ice this morning on birch's branch, into the waiting cup, all set with amethyst and knobs of bronze. Forth he went, innocent in his energy, deep into the bare wood, clean of leaf this February. I am myself the song I sing, he sung, I seek the hill of stairs, the stars clamor my heart to climb, I came, a stranger, to the court I leave. Sing, wood I wend, and wind soft, soft in the net, dark my sun weaves. Oh, those musics thrust me forth, no music can undo the heart I sleeve. I am my way, my own upon these woods, and into I go. He went in what sung him. My father sent me forth that I might find him. I am my mother, my sister, myself in knowing nothing of them, or if they were, a foundling cursed with the blessing of no nurse I call my own. I am of old, and on the tip that rends. I am the gut upon the lute fair hands linger their fingers over, learning the modes, rough and smooth, the beauty of the exercise, boring a maiden into tune. I am the mistake, a wrong setting that goes forth ever before knowing the hour. Horos, my master called him, limiter, inside whose bounds we know nothing but the reach inside us. I am good Valentine, setting out. Can we turn to books now for his tale? No, although we know it, we must allow this wood the ply, Thomas alone on his horse plays upon its pleach. Eschew a reader who knows an end stands before the journey. What tossed Valentine's sleep into morning? The sun this day, sure upon the sill, the room he left, is it a sickness at its noon, the fever returning when it sets? Give him his wooden hill and let him go, that alone can get him into his night. The next day will untangle itself upon the sky's treed hood. Blessed, I let him have his eyes that see. he casts his bread upon, this and water enough of heresy. Enough of sacrament, birds, choir, my mass, my mind is the cathedral that hid the tiny lady chapel I prayed in, that I may in either arch or lintel have the strength to fight my architecture. Am I not bound by all unbinding? Am I not young enough upon my stride? Am I not naked enough? Go out. Let the hoarse water hear them wander away with my armor tied to her rings. Let them sing at home of Valentine who met the sleek beast of his undoing at the spring he stopped to drink from. Let me set out in the end, all may tell, calling it mine. Good Sir Thomas Valentine. Thought to seek a mountain, hewn of timber fit for floors, once a thing that shade, once a thing whose shade he shivers under, shirtless. I am not a nymph now, nor maid, nor anything you know who gurgles in this well your horse bends her neck down to, that small scratch above her right eye with a dead thorn snapped back 20 minutes ago, at the inner reach of this outer wood, I am the consequence of your eye landing, in this moment against the sound of her lapping and a spot of fresh blood dried slowly leaving the faintest of traces upon what it is you brought here. I slip in from no rebuke, hardly part of the mention you made of the beast, the fur combed out sleek coat of a brother, maybe here or farther on. I speak as a whisper of everything the old tale cannot lay out, foretell. Here in the twitches of your horse's ear, in the warmth of the day, bright upon that armor you stripped off, I free you. I am the detail that knows nothing but you noticing it. I gleam in the place your looking makes for me. I am the heart of the matter. Ah, such silk as rises from the stuff a pod embeds around its seed confuses. Such talk leads the head to think it speaks bird speech, intuition of a teaching most baroque. Flen, wren, flourishing of trumpet, cock, robin, strings, fret and air, velvet in. Good Thomas, naked to his waist, watches his horse shrink upon his optic globe, now gone into that briar of all darkening nerve. Reins to the bridle bit of seeing this possibility in her going away, sinking deeper into tunes, beaks break twigs, branch upon branch, out from a trunk, up sap springs. The season, the wood or wind, what changes? Bonheur, oros, eugenesis, breeding good and well and freely, this hour our hero hones himself upon. Be mine, Valentine cries, his breeches loose, drop and he steps out. I am lust, and all that sought me here burns in my embrace. All that raises rage I trample like my second skin, sloughing off a shadow. Day the night held in my cold, shivering arms. I am reduced to a dream, or seem so, a rock beckoning me unto its veins. Slow, oh how so slow, it taught a beat whose frequency nothing faster had the wit to see. Am I Merlin, locked within a rock, I dreamt? Words, lures, rhymes, bait. No, I am Thomas Valentine, naked in this wood. I am the mask of my own true flesh. My skin oak bark, elm, or ash in winter, cradle of that fruition spring knows nothing of, nor awaits bloom the ripe its seed. I only undergo. Far here from book or hearth, all legend ends, short upon some detail, that rock near me croons, and for love of its song I would gladly enter it. Does each page turn or tongue lap back its vowel in warning or instruction to strike me dumb upon this now? Do the stories come like Merlin's out of where we go? Can they prepare us? Am I the preposition of what caught my fancy long ago? In good Valentine, that part of him yet waking his mind is the axes, laddering the solution he looks through. Sheen a glamour at an edge rigorous as that circuitry, thought clotting in its flow gives his romance currency. Is the Merlin he mentions Merlin or the Ryman Christoffel tensor? Has Thomas come late to a last supper celebrated elsewhere, arriving an hour early to leave the upstairs room and kill time in the markets of this little city, whose merchants can fix anything's price and still make a deal? and amber-lowed look-birds wept you a bargain, my boy. I'll throw in this flick of frog-legs, none better in all Araby. Come on, by, fall in, disturb these filings of this iron water. How about a girl whose mother's taught her so many stories she saves anyone's neck? Yours, maybe, she's my daughter. And a gnat in Byzantium's ointment, they can't get her ground glass out of their nard, out of their balm. She's the rough part, irritating the hell in them to inflammation. They can't help noticing her entering their stone. You can't keep your eye on both at once or bicycle round Kitty Hawk on a singer, now can you? Ah, I am old. I talk through my turban. My heart's not in conning you. But I have my hobbies. Let me turn from hawking to falconry and Istanbul you, Jew you down, for that glove sheathing the pretty hand, shading your vacant eyes from the sun lighting on those knuckles. If you stopped here once, you've stopped a thousand times. This stall's goods. You've browsed. I pass off forgeries, fakes. My magic no match for your clean intent. I watched influenza nearly wipe out the known world and saw war. All you fear, I've been through. I'm an old fart. Laugh in my ass. I'm God going west, back to all he shuffles past. Stale and lingering, the smell of me like the chill you tear a house down to get rid of. All I have's gone. My daughter, she works for a good family, has a bed beyond the kitchen in the basement of some stately home. A lazy slut. Go there, she sleeps a lot. When she wakes, look, oh, look upon her. Can a wren in rock pluck henlight? In this wood, I, good Valentine, make a fool of myself in what those boys with cyclotrons call noise. Some cheap trick makes me leap, so many Marys rushing to the tomb to take a sacrament what walked by without a word. I finger the wound, down the stairs. So this is what deal is, roughly 9 wide, 3 or less thick, 72 no longer in feet, 6. Of course, in a case like this, cut in lengths, appropriate steps. The kitchen? No. No, you're letting too large a detail just throw you off the track. If this were a room or a horse you go down, you'd need the boards as they come fresh from the yard. Pine, isn't it? Norwegian white. Thank you.
One of the poets that I began working with when I was quite young, about your age, was Louis Zukofsky. And Louis was a very quiet and diffident sort of character and hated to give public readings. But he did on rare occasions because I said, well, you know, is it important or why do it? And he said, it's always important because you've got to allow people to hear the noise in the poem, which is an expression I've always enjoyed. And he didn't much care about whether you understood it, but he wanted you to be able to, I mean, he felt that you could not understand what you had not heard, in other words. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I thought I'd start with some poems that come out of the experience of walking in the Appalachian Mountains in North Carolina, essentially, where I come from. I got on what they call the Appalachian Trail one year, which is a wonderful footpath. It's like the Pennine Way, but it's 10 times longer. It goes from Georgia to Maine. It's 2,249 miles long. And I said I had aspirations of walking this thing. Having 4 months in hand, I discovered I couldn't walk that well. But I did walk 1,500 miles. And it was great because for the first time in a long time, instead of running around the United States in an automobile, I had a chance to sit down and talk to people on the way. Time was not the problem at all, as it usually is for most of us. So the poems in this group, which is out of a book called Blues and Roots, Rue and Bluets. First half is Robert Duncan, the second half is Charles Mingus, so that's kind of the way I do things. those are all things that bluets are one of the nicest flowers along the ridges of the Smoky Mountains. They're all the words of somebody else's. Lest you worry about that, I put the spaces in. And I think that's where the art, if there is any. We all have the same words, essentially, so it doesn't really much matter whether I make them up or whether I find them. That doesn't really bother me either. I prefer to find the words because that allows my own eccentricities and neurotic behavior, etc., to be removed from the words, so it makes them more available for other people. So, as I say, these are all found, and I just put them down. B. Hensley hammers an iron chinkapin leaf on his anvil near Spruce Pine, North Carolina, and he cogitates on the nature of two beauty spots. In the Linville Gorge, I know this place. Now it's a rock wall. You look up, it's covered in punctatum all the way to heaven. That's a sight. Up on Smoky, you ease up at daybust and see the first light in the tops of the tulip trees. Now, boys, that just naturally grinds and polishes the soul, makes it normal again. I mean, it's really pretty. These people are north of England, Ulster, Scots, who left those parts in the 18th century. When they got to the eastern seaboard, they immediately headed for the hills, the sort of country that they'd had before. And they've been less disturbed than anybody else in America. They're essentially non-reading, non-writing people. Presumably that's why they're these extraordinary talkers, as you'll still get in the Celtic fringe, and you'll get them where I live here, which is up in Dentdale. You'll get hill farmers who have this kind of language. Different words, but the same impulses. This old man is a legend. I never met him, but just heard the talk. Daddy Bostane, the Moses of the Wing Community Moonshiners, laments from his deathbed the spiritual estate of one of his soul-saving neighbors. God bless her poor little old dried-up soul. Just make good kindling wood for hell. Used to be an old man named, he was a hermit of sorts, given to speech occasionally. Cackleberry Brown, he was known as. An example of how the locals took what we call an egg, and slightly more refined people call them hen fruit, but the real mountain people call them cackleberries, which is a lovely term. Why he was called Cackleberry Brown, hardly opening his mouth ever, I don't know, but the hermit Cackleberry Brown, speaking on human vanity, can't call your name, but your face is easy, come sit. Now, some folks figure they're better'n cow flop. They ain't, not a bit. Just good to hold the world together like hooved up ground. That's what. Most of the people who talked the best were people who made things, not just the language like this, but people who made brooms, or people who made churns, or people who made whimmy-diddles, toys. I guess it sort of goes together. This is a man called Lee Ogle in a place called Gatlinburg, Tennessee. If any of you ever go to the Smoky Mountains, you cannot avoid Gatlinburg with its 300 motels. And it's a real classic American town now. Lee Ogle ties a broom and ponders cures for arthritis. "The land's them fingers really dreadful to me. I couldn't tie nary broom one. Had to soak them in water hot as bird's blood." Then I hear this old man from Kentucky say, "Take a jug of apple juice, just juice, not cider. Pour the Epsom salts to it and take as much as you can." Being fleshy, I can take right smart, but boys, you know, it moves a man's bowel, something terrible. Boys, it just naturally killed that arthritis, lost me some weight too. I still tie these yard brooms pretty good. A little harvest poem from Uncle Ivan Owens. Really extraordinary teller of stories. Lived across the road from our farm for many years. It's called The September Satisfactions of Uncle Iv Owens. I got a rat-proof crib. And that was a day's conversation for him. With the advent of the Earth People, you got a mixture of cultures down through the mountains now, particularly if you go into the Smokies. So I'd been hiking up on the ridge for a few days and came down and had to get back to an automobile which was parked somewhere on the other side of the mountains. So it's called A Ride in a Blue Chevy from Alum Cave Trail to the Newfound Gap. Going hiking? Well, get in. Oh, the Smokies are okay, but me, I go for theosophy, higher things, Hindu-type philosophy, none of this liquor and sex. I like it on what we call the astral plane. I reckon I get more ethereal by the hour. Buddy, you won't believe this, but how old you reckon the Earth is? The Earth is precisely 156 trillion years old. I got this book from headquarters in Wheaton, Illinois, says it is. I'll tell you something else. There are exactly 144 kinds of people on this Earth, 12 signs, and the signs change every 2 hours. That's 144. I'm Scorpio with Mars over the water. Here's something else interesting. Back 18 million years, people was only one sex only. I'd like to explain that. It's right here in this pamphlet, 50 cents. Never married, lived with my mother in Ohio. She died. I'm over in Oak Ridge in a machine shop. Say, what kind of place is Denver? Think I'll sell this car, go to Denver, set up a center. Name's Davis. What's yours? Remarkable. Old mountain woman called, well, I'll tell you what she's called in the poem. She made the most beautiful quilts and coverlets that anyone had made in that part of the world. The Ancient of Days. Would that I had known Aunt Cumi Woody, C-U-M-I pronounced Cumi. She lived in the Dayton Bend section of Mitchell County, North Carolina, many years ago. There's one of Baird Wooten's photographs of her standing there with her store-bought teeth holding a coverlet. She sheared her sheep, spun and dyed her yarn in vegetable dyes, and wove the coverlet in indigo, the brown from walnut roots, red from madder, green from hickory ooze first, then into the indigo, the blue pot. Cumi, from the Bible, St. Mark 5:41. Talitha Cumi, damsel, I say unto thee, arise. And she is gone, and she enjoyed her days. Another lady in Mitchell County, Mrs. Sadie Grindstaff, weaver and factotum, explains a work principle to the modern world. I figured anything anybody could do a lot of, I could do a little of, maybe. Uncle Iv again. Uncle Iv surveyed, this is an ancient Celtic tradition, I think. The liberation of any sort will be long coming, long time coming in the Appalachian Mountains. Uncle Iv surveys his domain from his rocker of a Sunday afternoon as Aunt Dory starts to chop the kindling. Mr. Williams, let's you and me move t'other side the house. The woman chopping wood's might nigh the awkwardest thing I seen. Three of my mountain friends in the Highlands, North Carolina. First one is Doris Talley, who's a lady who grows flowers for a living. just happened to say one afternoon, "But pretty though as roses is, you can put up with the thorns." Butler Jenkins is a caretaker. You live until you die, if the limb don't fall. Sam Cresswell, auto mechanic, your points is blue and your timing's a week off. An epitaph I found on a mountain range called Iron Mountain over in Tennessee. Put up by no one knows who when this old hermit died. He'd lived 40 years on the mountain. Only came down once a season to get his meal and a few supplies. And somebody down in that valley put this thing up on this stone, which kind of sends you looking into the Greek anthology to find its equal. The epitaph on Uncle Nick Grindstaff's grave on Iron Mountain above Shady Valley, Tennessee. Lived alone, suffered alone, died alone. Lest you think these people are too good to be true, there is another side to people who are that local. This gentleman, unless you've traveled in the States and listened to a lot of AM radio, you couldn't possibly know who he is, but he's as close as we come to the Reverend Ian Paisley. He's on 1,000 radio stations in the United States every morning, cursing everyone. The Catholics and the Jews and the niggers and everybody else, but anyway, just anybody. Dear Reverend Carl C. McIntyre, just a note to let you know we are listening to you on station KIKE in Richmond, Virginia. There are four of us fundamentalist Baptist ladies who ride to work together at 7:30 to the shirt factory and the napalm plant, and we always listen to your 20th century Reformation hour every day after the early morning Motown sound show with urethra and the catheters. You both do, baby. I mean, you let it all hang out, and no doubt. So when you laid that wicked world bit on our heads Friday, we felt we should be prepared to meet God in goodness. We sure would feel lost without your spiritual uplift in our new pink Dodge Polara. Yours again, sin, and keeping those darkies from destroying our freedoms. Zangadang, Myrtle Jean Pugh, co-captain James River Industrial League of White Women Bowlers, team number 16. Some more recent things are, since I live a lot of the year now in a rather small valley, nay, Yorkshire now belongs to Cumbria, this new creation, called Dentdale. The reason for being there is to find a similar kind of folk and also mountains in which to walk. So that's why I'm here about half the time. And I've been using, I read maps more than I read fiction, so I read a lot of maps and I go to these places whenever possible, talk to the people about the names and what things are called and all that. This is a little book now gathered into a bigger one. It's called Imaginary Postcards, and the artist Tom Phillips and I sort of conceived of this thing as I would give him a text and then he would make an image. So this is like the caption on the postcard, and Phillips would take it from there and make an image. That's more or less the rule. Imaginary Postcards, which is subtitled Clints, Grikes, Gripes, Glints. If you know that limestone country, you'll know that clints are limestone terraces which have been eroded away. So you get your sort of living Henry Moores right there in place. And then the grikes are the spaces between the erosion, and gripes are muck forks, and glints, I presume, are glints. I've never been able to find another meaning for that. According to the English dialect dictionary, it's a glint. Oh, and it has an epigraph from the Reverend W. Thompson, the vicar of Sedbergh in 1891. I am reminded that the sight of exuberant affection is generally distasteful to the disinterested. A Dalesman considers Edgar Allan Poe's assertion that cellardour is the most beautiful word in the English language, and he comes up with the medieval name of the valley of the whirling, splashing river between Reith and Richmond, Suala Dala. George Fox moved to open to the people that the steeple house and the ground whereon, no more holy than a mountain, speaks from a stone on Firbank Fell by Crocaloin. A glimpse of the secret path from Hilltop Farm to the door in the back of that hill called Catbells, used by Beatrix Potter to visit dear Mrs. Tiggy Winkle. A series of five charred, blackened lumps served as mixed grill by the High Force Hotel, Upper Teesdale, County Durham. From the shapes, please tell us which are: 1, the sausage; 2, the lamb chop; 3, the mushroom; 4, the tomato; 5, the kidney. A full frontal card of Mr. E. M. Forster being touched upon the buttocks by Edward Carpenter's Uranian friend, George Merrill, in the Greenwood near Milnthorpe, Derbyshire, in 1913. Line drawing indicates path of the sensation from the back, figure A, into the ideas, figure B. This is my homage to Basil Bunting, which needs to be delivered by a shepherd. I can't do the dialect or the accent at all, but homage to Basil Bunting. 3 miles of glishy shorch on great Schunner Fell. The buildings of England. Professor Pevsner, unbowed by culinary deprivation, stands on the Cumbrian foreshore at sea scale. Quote, "On the front is there's nothing to report." T.S. Eliot once told Herbert Reed he should count himself lucky to live in Yorkshire, home of Wensleydale, the Mozart of cheeses. Shall we conceive a monument, Mozartian or perhaps Handelian, to be built on the banks of the River Ure? This is a poem that seems to owe something to Frederick Delius, who really is responsible for me coming to the Yorkshire Dales. I had to get close to somebody that I thought was that good and figure out what effect the landscape had on him. Browsing through Playboy magazine's advice column, in a summer garden along Outershaw Beck, one encounters a prime instance of what the Germans call Divisionsschaft des nicht Wissenswerten, the science of what is not worth knowing. There being only 2 calories in the average ejaculation of semen, or a gentilist's should limit their daily consumption to less than 700 times a day in order to comply with the demands of the BBC's dietary program, Nationwide Slim 74. Richard Braithwaite of Westmoreland reports in a treatise on civility from 1630 that the tongue is a small member, but very glibbery. Tom Phillips, the artist, has been somebody whose work has interested me a long time, and I don't know where he came up with some of these techniques of his, but William Burroughs was one source, I suppose, but one can think of many others. And the fragments left, the way that people like Guy Davenport have translated Archilochus and Sappho, in which you're left with almost nothing. And just like, you know, instead of an arm from a statue, you've only got sort of part of a finger and a bit of the top. And the imagination has to do the cohering. Well, I was reading Havelock Ellis's, what's it called? Anyway, I call it The Excavations from the Case Histories of Havelock Ellis. I was reading that book of his, what the hell is it? Yeah, Studies in the Psychology of Sex, which is an interesting book. But it covers the ground and gets the job done, but it's, the prose is not, as they say, brilliant, but it's worth reading. Anyway, I thought to myself, what would happen if I take each page of that text and get rid of about 98% of the words and leave myself just the words I want and again, make my own connections. That's what I've done here. So we're not bothered with the prose at all. Mr. Ellis said, a certain preciosity in the manner of this communication may be put down partly to the nature of the literary avocations with which the writer is by preference occupied. It's a nice way of putting it. Anyway, Mr. Ellis's words in their new guise. History 3. And I also tried to knock these things out and to establish a kind of musical sense of spaces. So you actually almost have to look at these things. A lot of times are big spaces on the page, which are time intervals. Anxious to learn anything of other men and their organs, Turkish and other baths, there is the nude to be found. His favorite color is blue. He is able to whistle, to knit and do the simpler forms of needlepoint. 4. At school, sexual relations of the simplest kind. Since then, none. If it is there, it is there for use or abuse, as men please. History 5. Brotherly affection. Got into bed. Skin to skin. He said in all innocence, how your heart beats. History 7. To sleep naked with a naked friend, which I think is practically Sappho over again. To a quiet spot, History 10. To a quiet spot, two boys, in turn, in his mouth. He likes best to, but he has never asked anyone to. He is accustomed to refined society. History 11. It is a dark crimson. It affords me relief. The great physician, quote, "Masturbation," he said, "is death." A number of young men come. I tell them, "Kill yourself." History 14. Scotsman, 39. Eccentric Celtic family. Had to be sent away before the age of puberty. 15. In Austria, the Englishmen who come, summers for climbing peasants, are willing to pay the seasonal price. History 16. In bed with an uncle. 17. Not inclined to, never cared for, could not endure to. History 18. If England were underpopulated, possibly slight pangs of remorse. History 22. Always once a day, generally twice, sometimes three times a day, in a dark recess, in the gallery of the Olympic Theater, when Gustav Brook was performing. History 23. The sight of a naked river, increased by a young Turk smoking below the waist. 24. He loved to sleep with his brother. They slept in different beds, kept awake from wonder. 26. This load of inborn vileness. Recited the details of a Liszt rhapsody over and over for Clifford, and Clifford died. 29. I remember that a middle-aged homosexual novelist whom I had met only twice, whose name I have now forgotten, said to me, "May I call you Joe?" I said, "No." Mr. Ellis's conclusion after writing this book was, "Homosexuality is not less common in women than in men." So there. Another example of that technique I used on, with very different effect, I hope, by nature it would be. It's a piece called A Celestial Centennial Reverie for Charles Edward Ives, the man who found our music in the ground. And Ives, the composer, was so amazingly ignored and not played at all in his generation that when he wrote the Concord Piano Sonata of 1910, I think is the date on it, he decided he'd have to write a book which he would also give to the person to help them understand the music. So he published a piece called Essays Before a Sonata, and when anybody ever asked to see the music, he would also give them the book. In it, he talks about the transcendentalists of Concord, who are the subject of his music, and I was disposed to try this. So I took it apart page by page and put it back together again for my own purposes. And I like to do it the way Ives would probably approve of. He would just do it in bits as I feel like reading it. So the continuity is different each time. This is all out of the movement called Emerson. Modernism is, and he's a very cranky sort of composer, and he's a very cranky thinker, and I kind of catch him at it once in a while here. Modernism is an anachronism and is as futile as calling today's sunset modern. He hacks his way up and down. He makes us feel that we are free to do so, seeing the signpost to Erebus strong enough to go the other way. Originality works down through the crust toward the first fire, when a thousand wrought like one. Inspiration, all gone up in sounds, a home run at evening. The intellect is never a hole, it is where the soul finds things. The rivers in thought stream through us. Somewhere between jowl and soul, beguiling a few sensual mortals. Uncovers a deformed foot, gives it a name, somehow like to mix it up with sin. Spare nothing, want all material, convert all impediments into instruments, be hoarse as earth beat, sea beat, heartbeat, the time to which the sun rolls, and the globule of blood, and the sap of the trees. Hawthorne. His intellectual masks would weave his spell over us. Unlike something I had heard of Ravel, whose music is of a kind I cannot stand. Pleasing enough if you want to be pleased. Secrets of which he wonders at. The less guilty elves of the conquered elms play round his pages. Our music is something to do with the old hymn tune that haunts the church and sings only to those in the churchyard to protect them from secular noises, or something to do with the concert at the Stamford camp meeting, or something to do with the Concord he-nymph, not something that happens, but the way something happens, or about something that never will happen, or something else that is not. Movement, the Alcotts. Under the Concord sky, there sits the little old spinet piano that Sophia Thoreau gave the Alcott children, on which Beth played at the Fifth Symphony. A common interest in common things and common men, a tune the Concord bards are ever playing, while they pound away at the immensities with a Beethoven-like solemnity. Not much besides the memory of that house under the elms. In this world, in the next. Movement Thoreau. Not because he played the flute, but because he... Miles of space intervene between men. Measure that solitude. Grass from Iceland could be found in Concord, in which an ode to mourning could be sung. Let nature put him under her microscope, than hold her under his. Inside work out of doors, and time from demands of time. 40,000 souls at a ball game rubbing elbows don't bring men's minds closer together, and neither is their safety in stupidity alone. Somebody asked Thoreau if he found it lonely there, and he said, only by your help. They remind us that he died of consumption, but forget that he lived with consumption. These people who will die literally and with the pedal loud. Follow him some spring morning to Baker Farm. Pine groves. So soft and green and shady, druids would forsake their oaks to worship in them. Many in Concord knew that within their village there was a tree of wondrous growth, the shadow of which, alas, the only part they were allowed to touch. You know your Thoreau, but not my Thoreau. One low day, the sun had gone down, long, long before sunset. You know him not unless you love him. He knows now he must let nature flow through him, and slowly in reverie, amidst goldenrod, sand cherry, and sumac, he grew in those seasons like corn in the night, better than any works of the hand. It was morning, and lo, now it is evening, and nothing memorable accomplished. Darker, the poet's flute is heard out over the pond. Just a couple more. Let's see. This is a valediction for my father. All the old things are gone now, and the people are different. A little baseball poem. Shotgun Chuba thinks middle-aged Slovakian thoughts about the Brooklyn Dodgers one evening in Ohio along the Mahoning River. What does it all mean? It doesn't mean much. Ruth died, Gehrig died, a long way, a long time ago. Here's an anemone cortege for a blue-red river, which is a little epitaph for Duke Ellington. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing, and the elite shall syncopate Elysium. Basil Bunting comes to Quaker meeting at a place called Brigg Flats, which is down the river 3 miles from the cottage. So I often go with him. And one day after the meeting, he was looking in the garden, smoking and looking out over the fells, and said this: "My Quaker atheist friend, who has come to this meeting house since 1913, smokes and looks out over the Rothay to Holme Fell. What do you do anything for? You do it for what the medievals would call something like the glory of God. Doing it for money, that doesn't do it. Doing it for vanity, that doesn't do it. Doing it to justify a disorderly life, that doesn't do it. Look at Brigg Flats meeting here. It represents the best that the people were able to do. They didn't do it for gain. In fact, they must have taken a loss. Whether it is a stone next to a stone, or a word next to a word, it is the glory, the simple craft of it. And money and sex aren't worth bugger all, not bugger all. Solid, common, vulgar words, the ones you can touch, the ones that yield, and a respect for the music. And what else can you tell them?" Indeed.